We get the show underway this afternoon by welcoming into the program a journalist, a former senior advisor to President Bill Clinton, and the author of a number of books, including the first three volumes of what will eventually be a five-volume set on Abraham Lincoln. The first, A Self-Made Man. The second, Wrestling with His Angel. And volume three, All the Powers of Earth. We are pleased to be joined this afternoon by Sidney Blumenthal.
Thank you, Rich.
Well, I'm so excited to talk to you about Lincoln. I'm a Lincoln fan, and I've read a lot of books. And it's a credit to the incredible amount of research that you've done that you're able to reveal new things about Lincoln. And I'm curious, how much time did it take? How much research did you put into creating the first three of what will eventually be a five-volume set?
Well, I've been working since 2008 on these books, so I can't keep track. It's now, I guess, 13 years that I've been working on what has become a five-volume study of Lincoln's political life. I had no idea when I fell down this rabbit hole that I would not be out in 2021 and still be deep into it.
Well, I want to focus primarily on the most recent volume, All the Powers of the Earth, but briefly back to the beginning. And a revelation to me was the idea that the young Abraham Lincoln thought of himself in many ways as a slave. Can you explain that?
In 1856, when Lincoln assumed a new identity as a member of this new political party called the Republican Party, which was, some thought was a very radical political party politically, Lincoln had been a lifelong Whig. And he had, by 1856, joined this new party. And he went out campaigning in a presidential year for the party. And on the stump, he said, I used to be a slave. He joked, paused. They let me practice law. But he meant it about being a slave. And it goes back to his origin. His father was a poor dirt farmer from Kentucky who left Kentucky and went across the Ohio River into Indiana because Kentucky was a slave state. His parents had belonged to a small emancipationist Primitive Baptist church. They were opposed to slavery, and he was forced to compete with slaves for wages. But when they got to Indiana, they were very poor. And young Abe Lincoln was sent out as an indentured servant by his father, who garnished his wages. And Lincoln thought of himself, he said, as a slave, his father's slave. What's unusual about this and important is that Lincoln himself came up from poverty. He felt himself to be a poor, oppressed boy. And his statements about slaves and slavery are very different from many others because they often take the point of view of the slave and are very empathetic about the condition. He made a statement once about the slave being in a cell with and the keys being held to the cell were dispersed. There were 100 keys dispersed to 100 men in 100 different places, and the slave has no way of escaping. And everything is arrayed against him, All the Powers of Earth, which is a title I've taken for my third volume. And it was Lincoln, of course, who broke that power.
To anyone who might suggest that Lincoln was somehow above politics, you point out that nothing could be further in the truth, that he viewed the world in many ways through a political lens.
Lincoln was a consummate politician, and he was a politician to the marrow of his bones. And at the end of everything, after he achieved the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment and won the war, There were radical abolitionists who had known him for many, many years, and they reflected back, and they said, you know, he compromised, he, you know, did this, he did that, but only he could have done it. It took a politician to be able to do this of his level. Politician, and he learned it from the bottom up. You know, his first position was working in a job in the post office in his early 20s. He ran for the state legislature. He was the floor leader of the Whigs in the state legislature in Illinois. And he served one term of the House in the House of Representatives in Washington, ran for the Senate, of course, famously against Stephen A. Douglas, and held their famous debates, and was considered to be on the national stage by the time he was nominated as the Republican candidate for president in 1860 to be a little-known person. But in fact, he had spent virtually his entire adult life in politics and learning the ropes in every way. And it was those skills and that talent combined with his intelligence and his principles that enabled him to become the Lincoln we know.
Volume 3 is very much as Lincoln was shaped by that rivalry with Stephen Douglas, who is a very interesting guy. He was a powerful figure on the national stage, proposed the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which would repeal the Missouri Compromise. And those of us in Maine well acquainted with that. It was the agreement that allowed Maine to become a state in 1820, and then for the time being kept that tenuous balance between slave and free states. And in many ways, it was Douglas that provoked the attack on Charles Sumner by Preston Brooks.
Yeah, you know, Douglas and Lincoln were rivals for decades before they ran against each other, first for the Senate in 1858 in Illinois, and then for the presidency in 1860, and they knew each other well. Lincoln used to say, you know, Douglas, who was called the little giant, who was barely 5 feet tall, and Lincoln, of course, was 6'3". Lincoln said, he's a colossus, and I, you know, we just walk underneath his legs. Douglas was the most powerful person from Illinois, an incredibly powerful senator, and he had an overweening ambition to become president, which is why he created the Kansas-Nebraska Act, engineered it, because he had to organize that territory, which hadn't been organized, in order to build a transcontinental railroad, which he believed would be the great accomplishment that would make him president. And as a result of that, he opened up the territory to the question of whether or not it would be slave or free, and people fought in it, and it became Bleeding Kansas. There was a virtual civil war there, and it blew up the Whig Party, and it blew up the Democratic Party, and made possible the rise of Abraham Lincoln, drew him into politics again. Douglas, it's important to note, was a great demagogue. And he was a racial demagogue, and he did not hesitate to use every aspect of racial politics in his campaigns, in every smear, and he used them against Lincoln in the 1858 Senate campaign. And Lincoln really had to cope with these racial demagoguery these attacks, these smears, the very idea that Douglas said that Lincoln, this is the worst thing you could say about anyone, that Lincoln was for Negro rights. That's what Douglas said about Lincoln in 1858.
Yeah, and for what he called the...
He didn't use the word Negro.
No, and said that Lincoln was in favor of what was then called the amalgamation of the races.
Well, race mixing, that's the worst thing that you can accuse someone of. As a matter of fact, in the 1864 presidential campaign, Lincoln's reelection campaign, his opponents invented the word miscegenation. It replaced amalgamation to accuse him of being in favor of the mixing of races, another smear thrown against Lincoln involving the exploitation of race. And Lincoln had to face that all the way through his career and fend it off. He referred to, Lincoln was very obviously, aware of all this, and he referred to the debauchery of public opinion and constantly warned against this, this sort of thing. So if anyone thinks that we're in our own contemporary politics having to deal with, you know, racial smears and conflicts and so on, well, there's a long history of it, and Abraham Lincoln had to deal with it too.
We're talking with Sidney Blumenthal here on Downtown. Well, indeed, what goes around comes around. I found it very interesting that Douglas, among other things, said that Massachusetts was the real enemy of the state and the people because of their support for the Emigrant Aid Society.
Well, the Emigrant Aid Society was a group created by Massachusetts people and actually chartered by the Massachusetts legislature to send settlers to Kansas so that they could populate it to become a free state as opposed to a slave state. And they encountered people who wanted to make it a slave state, and there was an armed conflict going on in Kansas as a result. And they were all blamed by the pro-slavery people and others for creating and stoking the conflict. It was, they were called agitators. They were called every name in the book. And Douglas said that, you know, Massachusetts was treasonous for doing this. And so it was, you know, politics were getting more and more heated, and it, you know, it ignited into a flame and led to a very bloody civil war.
And even before that, the violence of Bleeding Kansas and then the raid on Harper's Ferry led by John Brown, and that did some potential damage at the time to Lincoln's cause in a way.
Well, John Brown had, who was to call him ardently anti-slavery doesn't even begin to get at it. He was a fanatic. He hated politics. He hated everybody in politics of whatever side. And he came to Kansas to support the Free State part, although he regarded all of its leaders as sellouts. And he rampaged there, became a legend, engaged in some murders, and then organized an attempt at Harper's Ferry to create a slave insurrection. It was completely misbegotten, and he got himself, he killed some people, and he got himself, most of his people were killed, and he was captured and hung. And he became a great martyr for the abolitionists, but he damaged the anti-slavery cause in the moment. And ironically, it actually helped Lincoln because the presumptive candidate for the Republican Party in 1860 was William Seward, the senator from New York, who had, was far more renowned than Lincoln. He was the front runner, and he was anti-slavery, and the anti-Republican Party movement smeared Seward with John Brown. And as a result of that, there was a question in the Republican convention that took place in Chicago in 1860 of looking for a fresh face. And Lincoln had some advantage in that. And it's ironic because, of course, Lincoln, as he said, had always been naturally anti-slavery himself. And as a result of that, in part, Lincoln got the nomination.
How important was Lincoln's speech at Cooper Union right in Seward's backyard?
The Cooper Union address in February of 1860 was the beginning of Abraham Lincoln's political campaign. He was nationally known for his debates with Stephen A. Douglas in 1858, which were reported in all the papers across the country and reproduced. And he had taken on the great Douglas. And in there were a group of Republicans in New York who wanted to see the prospective candidates and hear them. They had never seen Lincoln. They'd never heard his voice. They had no idea. They'd only read these accounts in the newspaper. So they invited him to speak at Cooper Union. They were also looking for an alternative to Seward. Seward had been deeply engaged in New York political wars, which are, as you know, acrimonious then as they are today. And if you think Bill de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo, you know, reflect, you know, a mutual contempt and hatred, and that that's the standard, that's nothing compared to what went on in the 19th century in New York. And so they brought in Lincoln, who they called, you know, the voice of the West. And he had a slight Kentucky accent. He did not look like, he was very tall, ungainly, slightly awkward. His suit needed a little pressing. And he spoke in a high-pitched voice. And when he started speaking, they thought he was something of a hayseed. But then they listened. And after a few minutes, they were enraptured. And by the end, they were all standing up and cheering because he delivered a speech that explained how the Constitution could be used as an anti-slavery document and used to in their present moment for their purposes to stop the expansion of slavery to the territories. And he explained every single argument that was made against them, and he logically and humorously and brilliantly articulated how to rebuff them. And they had never seen anything like this, particularly coming from a surprising figure like Lincoln, who they'd never heard before. And it had a startling impact on them and really helped make Lincoln into a figure that they all thought could be president.
It's a very interesting story, too, about while Lincoln was in New York, how they got him to the office of photographer Matthew Brady to do a little public relations work.
Well, you know, image making has been part of American politics from the beginning. The little group that had organized the Cooper Union address decided that they would take Lincoln to Matthew Brady's photography studio before his speech. It was on Broadway. Matthew Brady was the most famous photographer of his day. No one really knew what Lincoln looked like. There was not a real, you know, picture of him that had been in the press. They took him there. Brady arranged him for his photograph, made him look like a handsome statesman with his hand on a book and a Roman column by his side, and took this photograph, which was then reproduced after his nomination in Harper's Weekly, and then reproduced as a lithograph and distributed all around the country. And that was the picture that people had of Lincoln. And when it was all over, Lincoln said, "It was Matthew Brady's picture that made me president."
Now, how did our Hannibal Hamlin from Maine, who was a Seward man, end up on the ticket with Lincoln?
Well, Hannibal Hamlin had been a Democrat and was from Maine had been for Seward. And that's exactly why Lincoln needed him on the ticket. Lincoln needed a balanced ticket. He needed somebody from the other camp, and he also needed somebody from New England, and Hannibal Hamlin fit the bill. So it was the Lincoln-Hamlin ticket that ran in 1861. You know, there were many smears against Hamlin. I've been researching even now. In the 1860 campaign in South Carolina, the editor, the publisher of the Charleston Mercury, the biggest newspaper there, said that Hannibal Hamlin was a Negro and had Negro blood in him. And we're going to have a Negro president if Lincoln, and who he called a renegade, were elected. And you know, this sort of thing, like the birther campaign that was conducted against Barack Obama, has been going on for a long time. And Hannibal Hamlin was the object of it in 1860.
Volume 3 ends with the election and then the secession of South Carolina, which you point out, for anybody who tries to frame it under revisionist history, it was pretty clear in their statement what secession was all about.
Well, the ordinance of secession of South Carolina, which was the first one, followed by many others by the southern states, is very explicit. It says that they are seceding to defend and preserve slavery. That is the reason, and that secession took place. They felt that with the election of Lincoln, slavery was no longer safe, and so they withdrew from the United States. They separated. Lincoln is attacked in the first declaration of South Carolina for secession, and he's quoted. They say, you know, we can't be safe when Abraham Lincoln is elected. This is somebody who has said the country cannot exist half slave and half free, and who said that that slavery must be put on the ultimate course of extinction, which is, those were accurate quotes of Lincoln's. And they decided that they would destroy the Union. And the election of Lincoln himself was the precipitating factor that led to secession.
The first three books in what will eventually be five volumes, A Self-Made Man, Wrestling with His Angel, All the Powers of Earth, fascinating reads and a remarkable level of research and scholarship. Sidney Blumenthal, wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Rich. It's been my pleasure.